Welcome into a fresh episode of Fireside Sports presented by Oregon Sports News. I'm your host, Casey Mavitt. I want to introduce my special guest host, who's really like a brother to the show. You know, he's a little brother, but he's a really cool brother. His name is Bryant Knox. If you haven't heard his stuff before or seen his stuff before or seen his written stuff before, get out there and see it, man. He's one of the best Portland has to offer. He's Portland's brother. He's the show's brother. He's my brother. He's like brother man to all of you guys, and so you should really do your best to see what he has to offer. He's on Oregon Sports News. He's on Bleacher Report. He's on all these things. He's on ESPN. If they've got a website, you've seen him by now, I promise you. But if you haven't already, please do so. Bryant, how are you doing tonight, and where are you tonight? You're like Carmen Sandiego. Where in the world are you?
Well, first of all, I need to channel my inner Hulk Hogan and say, it's good to be back, brother. sticking with the brother theme. But as far
like,
as
Mickey Rourke and the Wrestler right before he cut
No kidding. Tonight I am broadcasting from Pit Stops Pit Stop Sports Bar and Barbecue Grill on Beaverton. It's a very wonderful place, I will say. It looks quite nice. The people are friendly. The food seems good. I'm not going to lie to you. It's the first time I've ever been here, so I'm mostly just observing at this point. But next time I will offer a full review. I'm sure it will be fantastic. Shout out to everyone at Pit Stop.
Well, I'm sure they appreciate the shout out, and you know, we appreciate sponsorship, so if they want to do something there, I don't think anybody at OSN would turn them away. But at the same time, if they just want a humble shout out from the Bryant Knox, at Bryant Knox, I don't think they would say anything about it. Well, it's good to have you back on the show. It's been a little while. I know you're a busy guy, and there's been a lot going on in the world of sports, and it's really good to sit down and chat with you about it. First things first, I don't know if you've heard of it. It's called the National Basketball Association. They've had some conference finals, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. They just ended this past week, or this week, however you're looking at that, however your calendar works. Mine, you know, it's every day, so every day is a new week. But as of Memorial Day, we wrapped up the conference finals. So I assume you've heard of the NBA. Maybe even the conference finals. Guy named LeBron, you know, a kid named Steph Curry, some random dude named Kevin Durant, you know, I don't know. Big name somewhere, I guess. They played in those things, those contests, and those are over. But did you get a chance to see them? Do you know how they went?
Yeah, I definitely did. In fact, you mentioned it's been a while since I've been on the show. I think last time I was on the show, there was legitimate optimism that we would have a finals matchup other than part four of Cavs-Warriors. I think that's how long it's been. So that's quite a shame, but that's also a nice heat check as to where we are in the NBA lifespan, because yes, I definitely caught the conference finals. LeBron versus Boston was just honestly such a great series. I know that there weren't too many close competitive games, which is always tough to see a seven game series go that way when the each individual game doesn't actually live up to that seven game hype, which right. Can be a little frustrating, but I think that, you know, Boston showed so much promise. LeBron just showed so much. Can we just call it LeBron-ness at this point? Like, what else do you call it? On the Western side of the bracket, I think Houston put up such a nice fight. I would have loved to see what they could do with Chris Paul in the final two games. But then again, you can't really hang your hat on that as a Warriors fan, because you know, you were missing Iguodala, which means maybe the series could have gone even better. But at the same time, Houston missed something stupid like 27 three-pointers in a row. So you also can't really just say, oh, it was, you know, our like, you can't really take credit for that because they were just missing wide open shots. Obviously, I'm a little scattered here trying to throw both series at you. But yes, I watched it. I enjoyed it. I don't hate the fact that we now have part four of the Cavs and Warriors, because I think that they both really, truly deserve it this time, whereas in years past, maybe they haven't as much. But I thought that the conference finals were very competitive, very entertaining, very good basketball all around.
So let's separate it real quick. So Golden State-Houston, you have game one that was a blowout. You have game three that's an epic blowout by 40-plus points. And then you have games two, three, four, six, and seven that are relatively close. I think there's a couple in there that I'm missing that were blowouts in Houston's favor, but you've got about three or four that were close, especially the last three. That series to me seemed a lot more competitive from start to finish, even if the final scores didn't illustrate that point. But it seemed like when Golden State was off, they were still at Houston's level. And when Houston was off, they were not even close to Houston's level. Is that fair to say?
It's very fair to say. And to take it one step further, it was very clear that Golden State was built to come back from a deficit and Houston was not.
Right.
I think that, you know, game six, Houston had a 17-point lead at the end of the first quarter.
Right.
And with basically every other team in the NBA, that means they're toast. They're going to start planning for the next game. But Golden State is just built to come back in quick spurts. And, you know, I can't remember exactly what the score was at halftime, but I think they got it down to 10. But then within the first 2 minutes, Golden State was up one. So it's like the entire first half that went all in Houston's favor just never even happened, which is just so unfair.
Right.
But, you know, I've gone on record as saying that Golden State has done nothing wrong. They haven't cheated the system. They've just found a way to do it better than everybody else. So I have no problem with that. But from a competitive standpoint, it is extremely demoralizing to just think that your entire first half of great, great basketball was a wash because Golden State can figure out an 11-point deficit in 2 minutes.
Well, in a tie game or even a 1-point deficit is like a loss when you're facing Golden State because there's no momentum there. So whatever Houston had in the first quarter, they lost in the second quarter. And by going into halftime with nothing to show for it, it was really Golden State's game to lose at that point. And they took the game and then ended up taking the next one also, which it's funny. This game started out 1-1, then it went 2-0, then it went 2-0. Then, you know, it's just weird that that's how it swung when we were expecting an epic 7-game series. And while it was epic on the whole, you look at it from a game-to-game perspective, and it kind of left something to be desired that neither team could really show up for both home and away games.
For sure. And, you know, going back to that game six, like, I hate to say it, and I would never say it against any team other than the Warriors, but if I'm Houston, I almost wish that I was up by 7 points at the end of that first quarter instead of 17.
Right.
Because that
relaxed.
Because you get relaxed, and that sort of sparks something in Golden State's mindset that they go into halftime and they know exactly what they need to do. And it's just, there's no other team like it in basketball. So, yeah, you know, like you said, the series was competitive, game to game, maybe not as much. I just, overall, I think it was what fans were hoping for, with the exception of the Chris Paul injury.
If that was the finals, not just the conference finals, who would have won MVP? Do you give it to Steph Curry? Do you give it to Klay Thompson? Does it go to Durant? Because while he struggled a couple games, he was the driving force. Who do you crown at the end of that?
It's a great question. It's one I hadn't actually thought of. You know, I think Durant was consistent enough that he probably gets it. Curry was fantastic in spurts, but you got to remember he also like really struggled at the start of that series because Houston was targeting him on defense and on offense actually. And so KD was probably the best player overall on average the entire series, but I did like Klay Thompson quite a bit as a difference maker. So my vote might go one of two ways between Klay and KD there.
That's fair. So switching over to the East, you have Boston going up 2-0. It's looking like the season's about to be packed in for Cleveland really quick. They win two in a row on their own. They go back to Boston, they lose again. Then they go back to Cleveland and win. Then they go to Boston and win. And that was Boston's first loss at the TD Garden in the postseason this year. That series also started out kind of lackluster and then got really competitive towards the end. But it was every other game, one team was outstanding, and every other game, the other team was okay. So kind of the same thing where you didn't really get a lot of epic back and forth until game six or seven when the whole series is on the line and both teams are playing for everything. Obviously, LeBron's the MVP because Cleveland won, and I believe Jason Tatum had the right to be MVP if Boston had won. What is your main takeaway from this series? I mean, does Cleveland have enough firepower in the series beyond this, or did this kind of show us that after LeBron, there's not much there, and it takes a depleted team like Boston to maybe hold them back just enough But is this going to be too much of a test for them going against Golden State?
Yeah, I think the series tells me one thing and leaves one major question mark. It's that LeBron James is good enough to carry his Cavaliers versus at least 28 other teams in the NBA.
Right.
And the big question is, do we add a 29th to that? And that's obviously Golden State, because you look at the way the series went, and just Boston had, I mean, don't get me wrong, they were shorthanded, right? They're without Kyrie, they're without Gordon Hayward. Those are two very, very big pieces sitting on the bench, which is a problem. Still, even knowing that, Boston looked like one of the best teams in the postseason, at least when they were at home. And then overall, they looked like one of the most promising teams in the league. And so you can say that based on that series, LeBron can take down them and 28 other teams. The problem is there's one team in the Warriors sitting there that's going to put him to the ultimate test. And Golden State is not like any team this current Cavalier squad has seen. That would be different if they still had Kyrie, if they still had a couple other pieces, but they don't. This is just such a hodgepodge roster at this point that you have to wonder if LeBron is good enough to get them over the Warriors. I think, you know, the easy answer is no, he's not, and I think that's a fair assumption. But then again, you just can't count out LeBron. The other thing that I learned from the series, though, if I'm being very honest, is that I am officially a Jason Tatum homeboy.
Yep.
Like I want to be that dude's best friend. I want to be his manager. I want to be in his corner some way, somehow, because I think that dude is just going to take over the league at some point. And it's unfortunate that he's not a flashier player just in terms of him getting the recognition. He doesn't need to be a flashy player. I don't mean that. In fact, we even saw a little bit of flash out of him in that game 7 when he dunked on LeBron and then turned around and chest bumped him. Like, you're 20 years old. You shouldn't be doing that, but you are. And that makes me so excited for what's to come. So yeah, you know, going back to LeBron, I think we saw the fact that he is somehow, some way, 15 years in the league at the top of his game. And that's just stupid, but I love it. But there's also a lot of positive things to take away from Boston as well.
So before we move on to the finals preview, you may recall last year when you and I were previewing the finals, or I think it was after game 1, and the Warriors had won handily and LeBron looked absolutely gassed running court side to court end. I mean, he was going blue line to blue line. The guy just had no gas by the end. I remember you and I were commenting how old and tired he looked. And then he made us look silly in games 2, 3, and 4 by looking like a young LeBron. Do you think we see that again this time, or do you think he's kind of learned that he has to pace himself on offense so that he can give that 110 on defense? And then the flip side of that is, where does that extra effort come from his offensive teammates? And we're going to see that from Kevin Love. We know we can't get it out of Tristan Thompson. Does that come from J.R. Smith? Does it come from George Hill, Rodney Hood? You know, there's so many different players they've got, but is there really anybody that he can count on as a primary scorer other than himself?
Hell no. But let me elaborate. I think
that's a good answer.
I think that he has enough weapons around him that he can find one player per game. And that's all he needs. I think if he can get Kevin Love going one game, that steals one. If he can get George Hill going one game, that steals a second victory. Like, if he can get J.R. Smith or Kyle Korver to just have one solid game where they shoot something like, you know, I know this is a huge ask, but it's really what the Cavs need at this point, something like 6 of 10 from the three-point line, right? Like, I know that's asking a ton of a role player,
right?
But if he can get something like that from one of those guys, that might be a third game they steal. And then at this point, you have a legitimate series. Now, in reality, I don't think he gets one player per game the entire series. I think you're looking at least 2, maybe 3, where he's just doing it all on his own again. And it's unfortunate for him that he's in this situation, but the honest truth is that he has been sort of the star slash coach slash GM for a very long time now.
Right.
And he's kind of made his bed and now he's got to lie in it. And you know, in his defense, whatever he does, he's going to look great. He could honestly go down 4-1 in the finals and still win MVP. Like, I know the last couple years that's been a discussion, should LeBron get it, even in a series loss, and it hasn't worked out his way. This year it honestly could.
Well, let's go way, way back. So before we do that, so LeBron is averaging something ridiculous, like 45 points and 7 assists and 7 rebounds and 14 steals and 5 alley-oops and 7 dunks and 5 new shoe deals a game. I mean, it's just
Sounds about right.
What he's averaging. But it really isn't when you look back over the course of his career. But we've seen this kind of output before. I mean, we're not going to get into the Jordan versus LeBron debate because that's a whole string of episodes down the road. But Jordan put 7 points into one postseason. It was in 1989, which is when he carried the Bulls into the conference finals and lost to the Pistons. Now LeBron has passed Jordan on that. That's a Freudian slip, I guess. Maybe I just told you that I think LeBron's Jordan. But you have to go back to like 1969 when Jerry West averaged, I believe, 40 points over a whole series, and he set a record for most 40-point games in one postseason. And the funny thing is that Jerry West was the last losing player to be elected MVP of a series in the finals. Is that what it's going to take for LeBron to get the recognition he deserves to be one of the top two players of all time, whether that's him over Jordan or Jordan over him or however you want to manage that? What do you think he needs to do to get there, or is he already there?
Man, that's a complicated and tough question. What I would say is that, on Bleacher Report just recently, Adam Frommel wrote a piece that talked about how LeBron may not be the current GOAT, but he may also be the boat, meaning that he's not the greatest of all time in terms of impact, but he may be the best of all time in terms of ability on the court right now. Like, if he were to retire right now, that might be the case. And I think that's a very valid argument. And here's the thing. I have been, you know, hashtag Team Jordan for a very long time. I've loved LeBron since he came to the league. I think he is not only the premier athlete that the NBA needed, but he's also just the premier citizen as far as who he is and how he promotes himself in such a positive way. And he's a family man and all of that good stuff. But all that said, I've very much been Team Jordan. But man, LeBron makes that argument tougher and tougher to make just game after game, year after year. And I'm not going to go on record as saying he needs to do one definitive thing to pass Jordan in that argument. But what I will say is that people need to stop knocking LeBron for silly things that they have in years past, right? Like, if you're still saying LeBron's clutch, you're not paying attention to what he's doing. If you're saying that LeBron has lost in as many finals as he has, I agree that's a valid argument. But at some point, that can't hold as much weight as how many finals he's been to.
Right.
Like, the dude just goes to championships. That's what he does. No NBA player has done it the way he has, except maybe like Bill Russell. If you want to count Jordan, I understand because of the two gap years, the two gap playoffs. I get that. But like LeBron losing in the finals is a...
So, I mean, he went to quite a few. And, you know, a lot of people have argued over the years that maybe that's the more fair comparison. But I think maybe, and in my opinion, Magic's a top five player all time, maybe even top three. Now, if you say the top three is LeBron, Jordan, and Magic, and I don't know what order that goes in, I think that's okay that you've got, you know, maybe Jordan won more consistently, but LeBron does so many things, and he's carried some just awful rosters to the finals, and this year is definitely one of them. Last year wasn't much of an exception. Neither was the year before when they lost Kyrie in game one. You know, you talk about Jordan in 89. That was the last roster he had where he really had to carry them in, and he didn't get past the Pistons. Now, obviously, LeBron didn't face the 89 Pistons this year, but shouldn't that count for something, how much of a train wreck it's been that he's had to carry all these teams through the conference finals and into the finals and still be competitive?
It definitely should. You cannot discount that. Like, you can't just look at the championships in a vacuum. You have to look at the context of all of them. And LeBron just getting his team to the championship this year is probably the second greatest accomplishment of his entire career, behind the 3-1 deficit comeback championship 2 years ago.
Well, and he's done all that stuff, and he's done a lot of it without help, and supporting cast means a great deal, and I think that's why people like to give Tom Brady a little bit of an edge, or at least a 1-to-1 when they compare him to Joe Montana, because they look at what Montana did and how amazing he was and that he never lost in the Super Bowl. They look at Tom Brady and say, you lost a couple times, dude. Obviously, you can't be the GOAT. But then you look at all these other things he's done and how little talent he's had around him in the years he has won. It's just insane how good he is. And I think that's why, even though some people don't like him as a person, or they don't like his playing style, or they don't like how fiery he is, they still have to respect that the numbers don't lie. The guy's a true winner, and he's maybe one of the best winners we've ever seen in the sport of football or any sport. I think LeBron's the same way, that he just gets guys over the hump. He'll carry whoever he has to. I mean, he's had Mike Miller and, you know, Shane Battier and some other guys that are just, they were way past their primes. And now he's got Kyle Korver. He's carrying Kevin Love on his back. It's just kind of funny to me that people are so quick to dismiss him as not even being in the conversation of greatest of all time.
Yeah, not only is he in the conversation, he has a valid, fan base out there saying or his fan base that is saying he's already taken over that has valid points, is what I'm trying to say. And it's one of those discussions that, you know, nobody's ever going to win. Kobe actually pointed that out on Twitter. I don't know if you saw this. Yep, after LeBron won his game and everyone started either, you know, talking him up or talking him down or whatever it was, Kobe jumped out there and said, hey, you know, we need to stop talking about MJ6. We need to stop talking about my five. We need to stop talking about LeBron's 8 consecutive appearances. Like there's just no winning this. Why can't we appreciate it all in the moment? And I think that was maybe a little saltiness on Kobe's part, not being included.
I was going to say, I don't remember anybody bringing up his five. So I don't think that's a problem.
No. Nobody brought that up until he did. So I think there was a little saltiness there. But the point still remains valid that it's all subjective. You know, there's no equation to figure out who is the best. So right. I think sitting back, enjoying it in real time, really is the best approach. Now, when they're all said and done, LeBron included, then we can look to have a better discussion about this. And I'm sure Kobe will still bring up his five.
And he should. I mean, he earned those. He could have had more. That's the thing that's kind of sickening about it, but it is what it is, and, you know, I love that Kobe's trying to play peacemaker while also stirring the pot at the same time. That's my favorite athlete comment of all time, is when they're like, hey, I don't want to pour gas in the fire, but by the way, if we're going to get technical, my five. Kobe out.
Mamba out.
Yeah. I did hear a good interview with Brian Scalabrine about calling himself the White Mamba, and I'm kind of wondering if he's going to get into the championship conversation about how he has one, he should have had a second one, could have had a third, but, you know, he wasn't the reason they won him, but he could still count rings. And I'm surprised that some of these other guys haven't done that and be like, you know, I won 8, so I don't know what they're talking about. Because you have, like, Robert Horry, who I think won 4 or 5. So there's some guys out there that I think have the same ring count or are capable of having the same ring count as guys like Kobe or Jordan or LeBron. And it's funny they don't kind of throw themselves out there like, if we're talking ring count, I think I'm in it.
Scalabrine, man, top 5 player of all time.
Oh, yeah.
Put me on record.
You can't take away what he did for those teams. You just can't.
Yep.
And
at me. Somebody at me.
I hope it's Brian Scalabrine, or at least I hope it's Michael Rapaport, who's basically the Hollywood version of him. So, moving on. So, last tease before we get into the finals preview. Now that we've seen how hard it is for teams to get to this point, gun to your head, do you feel like Portland is at that level where they could get this far in the playoffs if they got the right matchups, or even if, does that even exist anymore? Because we've seen how quickly teams got kicked to the curb in the divisional. they didn't even make it to the conference finals, and those were some really good teams, and they're losing in five-game series. It's basically embarrassing. Is Portland there, or do they have a lot of work to do?
No, Portland's not there, and I won't say that they have a lot of work to do because there are so many other teams that aren't there with them.
Right.
That, you know, to say there's a lot of work to do means there is a sort of blueprint or roadmap set up for top tier success, and you can see the end. The problem with Portland is that you can't quite see what gets them to the next level the way that their roster is currently constructed. And I think, you know, Neil Olshey, I have a lot of feelings on that guy at this point, based on his exit interviews and some interviews I've heard ever since. And they're not all positive, I'll say. But what I will say in his defense is that he had a couple interviews when the year came to a close and when the conference finals started and Houston and Golden State were going at it, where he said on record, he said, we should have been more aggressive at the trade deadline.
Right.
But it's not a travesty that we weren't, because I'm not sure there was a move out there that would have made us as good as the top two teams in the West. He said, I'm not sure there's a move out there that would have made anybody as good as the top two teams out West. Houston and Golden State were kind of just destined this year to play each other. And destined isn't the right word, because the two of their organizations have constructed their rosters and their staffs in a way that has really led to this. So give them all the credit in the world. But as far as the moment the season started, yeah, they were destined to play each other in the conference finals, probably in a game seven, which ended up happening. And so if you're Portland, you look at this and you say, man, we probably could have made some moves, but would they have been good enough? And I'm kind of with Olshey that no, they weren't going to be good enough to make it to a conference finals. So there's no way of looking at the year and saying, yeah, they were really close to this, because they just weren't. Nobody was. And that's not necessarily Portland's fault. It just is the way it is.
So looking back on that, would you have rather he was more aggressive in free agency before the season, or are you just hoping that he'll be more aggressive going into this offseason? Are there any moves that you would have made that he hasn't made, or are there some that he has made that you would maybe go back and nix if you had the chance?
If there was anything he could have done to get Kevin Pritchard to sell low on Paul George last summer, I definitely would have done that, even knowing what we know about the Warriors and the Rockets. Because the fact is, Olshey, I think it was Jason Quick of NBC Northwest who came out and said that Olshey was willing to trade all three first-round picks, plus anybody not named Nurkic, McCollum, or Lillard, to get Paul George. And that really was the second best offer on the table, behind the one that Indiana ended up taking that got them Oladipo and Sabonis. And so if I'm Olshey and I have this retrospect, like, maybe you consider throwing in Yusuf Nurkic at that point, because then you can get Paul George on board. Yeah, you give up three first-round picks, which is a big, big deal. And you give up a guy in Nurkic who has a lot of potential to become a, let's say, second-tier, maybe almost first-tier center in the league. Like, that's a lot to give up. But if you have a core of Paul George, Damian Lillard, and CJ McCollum, that probably gets you a heck of a lot closer to that top tier, top two teams than you would have otherwise. And I think that move gets you close enough that you don't regret it in the end, which is why I think in retrospect, you maybe try to sweeten the pot just a little bit.
Which is funny that we talk about that now, but Minnesota had a similar team and build to what Houston has, not necessarily in experience or success on the court, but on paper they were built similar, and they were ousted in the first round by Houston. Then you have Oklahoma City, who's also ousted in the first round by Utah, and they have a similar makeup to what Houston offers. And it's just funny that there's these teams that were trying to be super teams that couldn't even make it out of the first round. So to me, it's kind of comical that we make so much fun at Portland's expense for being swept by the Pelicans. And it turns out that they may have been one of the stronger teams in the league, and we didn't even realize it. And there's these super teams that haven't quite figured out how to play yet.
Yeah, the thing about New Orleans was that nobody saw that coming, right?
Right.
And I think that's what you were alluding to. But the fact that, you know, OKC fell isn't too surprising to me. I know I went on record on this show saying I'm scared to death of Utah. And that plus the just complete disaster that was Carmelo Anthony this year.
Right.
That didn't surprise me one bit. Now, with Minnesota, I really did think that they were going to be better during the year. Obviously, they had the Jimmy Butler injury, which was unfortunate for them. And I think if he hadn't gone down, they would have looked more like a six seed. Okay. But going back to Portland, that doesn't change anything at all because they got the freaking three seed, right? Like they were not dealing with a lot of the injuries that anyone else was dealing with. They weren't looking at it and saying, oh, man, we got a seed that's not fair to how we actually played in the regular season like maybe Minnesota was. And they got the three seed. They got a desirable matchup knowing that Boogie Cousins was out. But then, you know, Anthony Davis was just an MVP caliber player. Drew Holiday proved that he's a defensive player of the year candidate. And then guys like Rondo and Mirotić just came out and, you know, played incredible basketball as well. So it's one of those things where, yeah, Portland, you know, going back to a previous point here, if Portland had gotten Paul George, I think, yeah, they would have been much better off than they are now. I do think that him on that roster probably gets them past New Orleans just because of matchup issues. But even so, does that get them past Golden State in the second round?
No.
I'm not sure it does.
I don't think it does. I think you're still a piece short at that point because you've got basically no rotation if you do that trade. So you now have...
Exactly. For sure. And I think it's... I wouldn't phrase it they're a piece short. I'd say it they're a few minor pieces short because then you're not lacking one big star because let's assume you have to give up Nurkic. Then you probably throw in Ed Davis at center, and he's just a big enforcer there in the middle, and I think that's great. But then you're relying on Zach Collins as your major backup center or something else in the rotation that's a little bit wonky, and so I think you have a few pieces there that you could really add upon.
So in closing, do you advocate for them to do what it takes to add another piece this offseason, whether it's by trade to get Kawhi Leonard over here, if that ends up being possible, or do they just go through the draft and stick at number 24? Do they try to package 24 with an expiring contract and move up in the draft? What do you want to see them do?
I think there's a couple top-tier options and then a cop-out, and I'll go over all of those. I think that top-tier option number one is if you can package CJ McCollum and something else for a Kawhi Leonard. Obviously, you do that. Obviously, you risk Kawhi Leonard leaving next summer, and you risk a little bit of his health issues, but the truth is his value is very low at this point. And that's never, ever, ever going to happen again. So I think if you can do that, you do it. After that, you're probably looking at a package still around CJ McCollum, but maybe being able to get to Cleveland, who's going to panic a little bit this summer. And maybe you can get Kevin Love and the Brooklyn Nets number 8 pick for CJ. And, you know, I haven't looked at the math, but CJ, Mo Harkless and the 25th pick, something like that. That gets you in a spot where you not also have a big guy who can score and rebound, but you also have the number 8 pick in the draft, which I think is worth looking at. If you can't get something comparable to those two, I really think you cop out and you hold out and you say, hey, 2019 is not that far away. Portland's competitive enough to sell tickets, which, you know, isn't that important to me, but it's important to the organization.
Right.
And quite frankly, Golden State is coming up on a situation where they're going to have to figure out, do they keep both Draymond and Klay Thompson? Do they let one of them go? I personally think that they keep them both, but I also think that someone like Draymond Green is destined for a bit of a decline early in his career, just because of the way he plays. And so I think that if you can't get one of those top tier deals to go down this summer, you hold out, you figure out what things are going to look like next year. Then all of a sudden you have some expiring contracts like Evan Turner, which you can look to flip, and you can go from there. But if you can't get a top tier deal this year, just hold steady is what I would do.
Yeah, and I mean, if you're not going to get past those elite teams, you might as well just wait them out and see what happens. And then maybe when they wash out, you're at the top of the crop and you can actually make a run at it.
Exactly.
Houston did it in the 90s, maybe not in the same fashion, but it worked for them. They got two out of it, so good on them. We can try that.
Yep.
We just need Jordan to retire again, no problem. So on to the main event, the main card. We're into the finals preview. We talked a little bit before the show about doing this memento style. I don't know if that still works for you because it's going to be real confusing, but we're going to give it a shot if you're up for it.
I'm down.
So let's work backwards from the end of the series, and we're going to go from least complex to most complex. We're going to start out with the first of three scenarios, which is that the Warriors win in five. Walk me back through that. I assume that means the Warriors win four. How does Cleveland get a win?
Cleveland gets a win by, kind of like I teased earlier, finding a solid second option in at least one game. And I think that you're going to have games where Kevin Love looks like a good, solid option, but that's not quite enough. I think you either need Kevin Love to be good and someone like George Hill, J.R. Smith, or Kyle Korver to be good, or you need Kevin Love to be Minnesota phenomenal, and that makes up for anybody else. That's how they get at least one win, is one of those two scenarios.
And I would think a key component of this series is that the Cavs are going to miss Matthew Dellavedova, whether they like it or not. And that scares me to say out loud because he was fighting for MVP rights 3 years ago.
Yeah, they'll miss somebody of that mold. Not to say that if you throw Deli on this roster, that wins them a title. I don't think that quite gets it done. But I do think you're right. I think they're going to miss, you know, Dellavedova. And I know, gosh, what was it? Was it just last year when they signed Andrew Bogut, thinking he could be that big enforcer?
Yep,
and then he went down like 7 seconds into his Cavs career or something. Like, I think they're going to miss a Dellavedova who they're used to. And they're going to miss basically what Kendrick Perkins used to be. I know they actually have the real Kendrick Perkins on their bench.
Kind of.
But they don't have him out on the court. No. And they're going to miss those two things.
I think the league's been missing him since 2010, and it shows.
Yep.
So that's probably the most likely scenario based on the two teams' talent level and how last year went, and that Golden State is somehow even scarier this year now that they've had a year to play together. So then you work on scenario two, which is that the Cavs keep it close and stretch the games to at least six, maybe seven. How, you know, obviously Golden State's going to win at least three or four of those games at home. Maybe they'll steal one on the road in Cleveland. How would Cleveland win two or even three games in this series and make it an epic finals to remember?
You know, I'm not going to cop out and say that Curry and Durant get hurt, because honestly, that really is the most realistic option here. Right. But I won't go on record saying that. What I will say is your scenario happens if Cleveland is able to study the heck out of the film from the Houston Rockets and figure out how they took Stephen Curry out of the game. Because if Cleveland can do anything close to what Houston did in game one and even game two, even though I know they lost, where you take Curry out of the game on both ends, like you target him on defense and then you hedge every single screen to kind of do the same thing that New Orleans did to Damian Lillard, but against Stephen Curry, you're going to be in decent shape. Now, Golden State has enough weapons that's still dangerous for you. You know, he can kick it out to Durant and let him ISO in the mid-range all day long, but that's not what they're trying to do. So if you can really, really target Stephen Curry on both ends, that's how you're going to find yourself, you know, actually competing in a series.
Do you do that by putting LeBron on him and then double-teaming Durant and forcing the Warriors to win through Klay Thompson and Draymond Green, which I think is actually how you make it competitive, by isolating their two superstars and making their stars beat you? Or
I don't think you...
Go ahead.
I don't think you put LeBron on him, because then you risk LeBron falling off of him in high pick-and-roll sets. What I think, though, is you maybe put LeBron on Draymond Green, or you put LeBron on Kevin Durant for spurts. And as Stephen Curry tries to run the pick-and-roll with those guys, that's where you tell LeBron to switch everything. And then you end up with LeBron on Curry, and then Curry has to figure out what his next option is. I don't like him on there as a primary option, because I think Golden State would be too good at getting him off of Curry in that situation.
Is there a defender on Cleveland that you think could, obviously someone not named LeBron James, that could handle Durant for spurts, or do you think they're going to have to rotate guys out and throw different bodies at him?
It's got to be by committee. I think, you can't shy away from LeBron being on him. You don't want him to be on him primarily, because that's going to take away his energy on the offensive end. And as we know at this point, LeBron is their offense. But you have to throw him on there for spurts. And then really you just have to hope that other guys can have the stamina to stick with him for two or three possessions at a time before you get LeBron back on him.
And I think a lot of that's going to have to be LeBron forces or funnels the ball into Kevin Love in the post, because we've seen him try to get his guys involved when he gets tired, and by then they're already kind of checked out of the game and Golden State's relying on it. I think you got to decide who's going to be the second scorer on this team tonight, and whoever that is, you funnel them the ball early and make sure they get that confidence that they can score on this team efficiently and consistently.
I agree. That's just such a tough thing to do against Golden State, because they have so many good defenders, right? It's not like they can target anybody, or it's not like Cleveland can target anybody in particular past Stephen Curry, because Klay Thompson's a very underrated defender. Kevin Durant was looking like a first-team all-defender for a while. Draymond Green is a Defensive Player of the Year candidate every single season. So finding that guy to exploit is very, very difficult.
Absolutely. So let's turn it up a notch to the least likely scenario, which is Cleveland wins in 6 or 7, most likely 7. How does that play out? Is that something that would take a Durant or Curry injury, or do you see a possibility where Cleveland could steal this one with everybody healthy on the opposing side?
You know, I'm still not going to cop out. I will say that you're exactly right. You do have to have at least one, probably two major injuries there. But I'm not going to cop out there. I am going to cop out in one other way, though. And I'll say LeBron, in order for that to happen, LeBron plays 48 minutes a game the entire series.
Right.
And which at that point, anyway. Which he honestly might do anyway. And he would need to average just something unprecedented, like 45, 15, and 12 while shooting 60% and 40 from three. Like, it honestly, I hate
in four
to
games.
Say that.
In 4 games, he can take those other three off. Which
no,
might be the
for
way to
sure.
Go.
And I hate to say that, but you're exactly right, because if he can, you know, LeBron is not shy about the fact that he takes off defensive possessions.
Right.
He's not shy about the fact that this is the very first time in his career he's played 82 games, because he's very, very aware of what his body's capable of, and he's so good at keeping his body preserved for when it counts. Now, this is when it counts, and so maybe he's smart enough and his trainers are smart enough to say, hey, LeBron, we're down 8 points with, 6 minutes to go. Let's call this one a loss. Let's chalk it up as a loss. Preserve your body for next time. And next time he might go for that ridiculous 45, 15 and 12 on 60 and 40. Like, I think that's how they win, is if LeBron picks and chooses his spots and really just saves himself for when it counts.
So say that is his average, as you stated it. That's exactly what happens. What percentage probability do you give the Cavaliers in winning this series if that's the case?
Man, it's still less than 50%. It has to be. Because even with and not only is that an indictment on his Cavs, but it's more importantly a testament to how good the the Warriors are, because if he averages those numbers that I just rallied off, I think they probably get a couple games, and that's about it, because there's no way that even those ridiculous numbers can make up for four All-Stars and eventually Andre Iguodala being back on the court, who, you know, we didn't even mention him as a potential defender, but he when he comes back, his role is going to be defending LeBron James, and he already has one Finals MVP to his name because of his ability to do that. So you just can't count him or the Warriors out, even if LeBron goes Super Saiyan.
So now, knowing the most possible scenarios, which one are you picking? One of those three as what's going to happen, or do you have a fourth one for us?
I'm picking Warriors in five. I know that that's like the sexy pick right now, because basically every analyst on the planet is saying the same thing, that you trust LeBron enough to get a game, but you just can't count on the Cavs to win him anymore. Right. And so that's what I'm going with. I know it's chalk, it's cliche, but it's chalk and cliche for a reason, so I'm sticking with it.
Well, and we know that the game can go, the series can go six or seven without Kevin Durant in the mix. We know with Kevin Durant it went five last year, and that's what they're projecting it'll go this year, because the Cavs team is somehow even worse, and yet they're still going to spot them one game. I think it will go six, just because I think that they find a way to get Korver and Love and Hill involved for at least two games in a way that they can beat Golden State, and I think both those games are going to have to come in Cleveland. I don't think there's any way they win an Oracle, not without a miracle, and that miracle would have to be like Kyrie Irving rejoining them fully healthy, which isn't possible because he's on another team and he's not healthy, but I think Warriors in six is where I'm going. I think that if the line is at five, I want to see one more game.
All right, so here's my bold call, right? I'm sticking with Warriors in five, but my bold call for the series is I think LeBron actually wins game two. Huh. I think he steals one in Golden State, because I think Golden State gets complacent. I think they probably win game one by something crazy like 17, 18 points. And they get super, super complacent. And I think LeBron puts together a perfect game plan in his own head to get somebody else involved. I don't even think it's going to be on paper or in Ty Lue's head. I think LeBron says, hey, I'm going to get Kyle Korver 15 points tonight.
Right.
And I think that that's the difference maker in game two, because nobody sees that coming. Then after that, Golden State's good enough at its adjustments that I think they realize, oh man, LeBron is kind of outworking us as far as the alterations go. Let's figure this out. And then they close out the series back at home in game five. But like I said, bold call, I'll make one of them, even though I've copped out over and over and over again. LeBron steals game two on the road.
I don't think you copped out. You opted out of calling a major injury just to make the predictions harder on yourself. I think that was very well done. I appreciate your effort there.
Thank you.
Well,
it was tough to do.
It sounded tough, and you know, I hope that your predictions ring true, because it's always nice to be able to celebrate a familiar face and a local face. So we're going to check out, because we're approaching 50 minutes, and that's way over a 30-minute promise to you guys. So we appreciate you sticking around for the extra 20, and you know, which is much better than the Regal 20. I don't care what they say. And speaking of Regal, enjoy the series with the King. We don't know if this will be this last trip to the finals or not, or with what team. So that starts tomorrow night on Thursday night. Catch it on ABC, I believe, is the network. So it's not TNT or ESPN like it has been. So if you haven't had cable, you probably haven't seen the games. You have no idea what we're talking about. But make sure you check out the finals. It's going to be an epic fourth serving of this. So this has been Fireside Sports, presented by Oregon Sports News. I'm Casey Mabbitt. He's Bryant Knox. Make sure you check him out at Bryant Knox on Twitter. Make sure you check him out everywhere else, because, good Lord, he's on everything. And he deserves to be, because he's a very talented individual. Thank you for listening, and have a good evening, and we will check you out next week.